Hello, this is Anita Herring, Social Media Specialist with the Military Families Learning Network, Family Transitions Concentration Area, and Extension Educator with the University of Minnesota Extension. The Military Families Learning Network Project is a national collaboration between the Department of Defense and the National Institute on Food and Agriculture Cooperative Extension. The Family Transitions Concentration Area provides education, resources, networking, and engagement opportunities for professionals working with military families to build resilience and navigate life cycle transitions. We know that military families experience unique transitions on a frequent basis. Some are easy to navigate, while others pose more challenges. Recently, I had an opportunity to talk with a military spouse, who would like to remain anonymous, about the transitions her family encountered over the years. Her husband served in the United States Army for almost 13 years. During this interview, our military spouse describes the transitions her family experienced related to military life and deployments, including her spouse's resulting combat stress and mental health issues. She shares how her children were impacted by military life, the challenges they experienced as they transitioned out of the military, and how they still view their family as military connected. In addition, she provides suggestions and resources that might be helpful for other families experiencing similar situations. Tell us about your experience marrying a military man and also your first year of marriage.
Right. So we met and married in 7 short months. We met right before he left for training, and then we got married shortly after he was finished with all his training, and then he went on to his first duty installation, and I followed a couple weeks later and joined him there. This was the first major move I'd ever made my whole entire life. You know, we were both done with college, but still it was a really interesting transition. And, you know, we had a great first year between the two of us. You know, I hear people talk about this terrible first year of marriage and, oh, we fought all the time. And, you know, we didn't have that. We had a ton of fun, just the two of us. And we were silly and we played and we just had a really, really good time. However, I had no clue that people lived like this, right? I had no clue that there was this level of unpredictability in people's lives. I grew up in a house where my dad worked Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. When my mother went back to work, it was the same kind of hours. I mean, it just was very predictable. I'm a very type A kind of person, so I like predictability. And when there wasn't, I didn't know what to do. And I started to kind of panic a bit because I was just so out of control and knew nothing of what was happening. And so I liken it to being dropped into a foreign country, right? So when I realized that, I kind of went, okay, so if I had been moved to a foreign country, if we had moved halfway around the world, what would I do? Well, what would I do? I would find out as much as I could about this new country we were in. I would find out about the language. I would find out about the culture. I would find out about, you know, what are the laws and the rules. And I would find out everything I possibly could. And so through the morale, welfare, and recreation department within the Army, there were these classes called Army Family Team Building classes. And every branch has something similar to this. They're called something a little bit different, and some of them are even more extensive and offer lots of other kinds of classes. But they also offer these AFTB classes, which are kind of this overview of the military language and customs and cultures and regulations and things like this. So that gave me a great deal of power and an ability to finally know this, you know, quote, foreign country I felt like I was in, and that was helpful. You know, but however, I still ended up pretty depressed. The lack of control just really threw me into an extremely deep depression. And, you know, 9/11 happened, and then there was even less control or predictability. And that in and of itself was really traumatic. And I just couldn't function anymore. I was seeing a therapist. I was medicated, but I was just very, very depressed. You know, and when finally orders came after about two months after 9/11, he did finally get orders to go to Afghanistan. And quite ironically, there was this weird sense of relief for me, honestly, that at least now I knew what was going to happen next. I had a job to do. I needed to get him ready to go, and I needed to support him through that. So there was a relief in that. You know, and that first deployment had its challenges, but for the most part, that time that he was gone was pretty, it was a lot less chaotic for me. I was able to start getting a lot better, and really improved. My depression lessened, and I was doing very, very well. His return date was changed numerous times throughout the course of that first deployment, which is somewhat typical, very frustrating, but somewhat typical. And, you know, I remember as a result of that, you know, thinking, oh, it'll be next month. Oh, nope, 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 next month. Oh, nope, nope, next month. I remember being really, really frustrated and finally just deciding, okay, you know what? It hurts too much to think you're going to come home. So we're just, this is just where we're going to go. We're going to just be like this. You're going to be there. I'm going to be here. We're going to live the rest of our life this way. And that's just the way it's going to happen. Because for me, it was less painful to just think, okay, this was it. This was going to be our life. Than it was to think, well, maybe you'll come home. Well, maybe you won't. Well, maybe you will. Well, maybe you won't. And so for me, I just pulled out emotionally. I still loved him. We still communicated all the time. But in my mind, he just wasn't coming home. And a lot of that's because I'm just really self-protective. And so I just kind of put in this wall in place, you know, that so that I would protect myself and keep myself safe. And that, you know, that served to drive us apart. I never really reattached to him, even since then, I think, and that's been years ago. It was what I needed to do at the time in order to survive that.
And it sounds like you tried to remain so positive and so proactive during, you know, the first part of the marriage and such. Now, your husband was deployed multiple times, you know, as you had referred to. Could you share how those deployments impacted your family?
Sure. So he left for about 8 months in 2001 for Afghanistan, and then he left shortly after the Iraq campaign kicked off. He was gone for about a year. And then we had this break in between for about 5-6 years, and he didn't go again until 2009 when he went back to Iraq for about another 10 months. And so you know, we were lucky in that he just went only these three times. And, you know, I have a lot of people will say to me, lucky only three times? What are you talking about? But, you know, I have friends who have sent their service member off 5, 6, 7, or even more times. So for us, yeah, three is just, it's a small number. And during those first two, we didn't have any children. So it just impacted us. And like I said before, I just distanced myself from him emotionally. It was too painful to try to remain emotionally attached to him, only to have him leave again. And I just, you know, I kind of just knew this is just how our life is always going to be, in and out, and in and out, and in and out. And I love you, and I'm here, but this is just what it's going to look like. And I can't let myself get as invested into you as I was before that first deployment, because it was just too painful. You know, when he came home from the first deployment from Afghanistan, I don't really remember like he was that different. However, it's entirely possible that he was, and I just didn't have time to notice. He was home for 7 months in between the first two deployments, and four of those months where we were just enjoying life and thought everything was fine, before we heard he was leaving again. So we had this four-month honeymoon period, and then, oh, wait, you're leaving again. So then there was this pre-deployment separation type of a thing emotionally, and we just, you know, I just kind of pulled out. But so he may have been slightly different, but I really don't remember that. What I remember, though, was when he came home from Iraq. And when he came home from Iraq, he was very, very different. And it's very hard to put into words what that means. I just remember thinking, you know, I remember saying, you're different. What happened? What's wrong? Where did you go? Like, whoever I sent out to Iraq, I didn't ever get that man back. He just wasn't the same. He was more, introverted. He was more withdrawn. He didn't want to participate in fun activities that we had previously done with couple friends of ours. He just wanted to invest. The only person he wanted to invest any relationship energy into was me. And unfortunately for him, I didn't want to invest that energy because I knew he would leave again. And so I was spending time investing energy into these relationships with my girlfriends because they weren't going to leave. And so we were just kind of pushing and pulling in two very different directions. You know, and at the time, I didn't know anything about what combat does or how it changes a person. I barely knew what had happened while he was gone. He didn't tell a lot of stories. He didn't give a lot of details. I didn't learn about certain things until almost 10 years later. So I had no idea. And, you know, when they came home in the early 2000s, your redeployment briefings, they were all logistical. We think they might get here at this time. We think they might be here at that time. Here's what you need to do. These are the days off that he's going to have. These are meetings that they'll need to be at. This is when we go on block leave. There wasn't this mention of, hey, here are the symptoms of PTSD for the family members. Not even an overview of what normal combat stress looks like for the family members. We were given nothing other than logistical preparation. You know, and I find it so interesting because as a new mom, when I had my first baby at a military installation, there was this class that my husband and I were both required to go to before we could be discharged. There were papers I had to fill out. There were briefings he had to attend, you know, and by briefing, I mean the nurse had to sit there and explain different things to him about postpartum depression, what to look for. So here I was, not even able to be discharged from the hospital with my baby until I had attended the class, my husband had attended the class, I'd been screened for all this postpartum depression, which that's good, right? That should happen. And that was happening for first-time moms, but it was also happening for my friends who were having their third babies. So they were doing it for every woman, regardless of what baby you were on. However, when these service members came home from a year in combat, the family members got nothing. I mean, I don't remember a single pamphlet or briefing or information, nothing, during these first two times. Now, that has changed, right? We know that's changed. And they started screening the service members, which was a good first step, but it wasn't enough. And now things have changed, and now there's more provided for the family members when service members come back. But at the time, there just wasn't any discussion. And I remember saying to my girlfriends, we don't know what we're doing. We have no idea. And we would, together in small groups, go, okay, so did you ask him about that, or are you just letting him talk? Or you know, when he wanted to go do that, did you, you know, we would talk to one another in a very one-on-one, friend-to-friend kind of way, but we were all going blind, and we just had no idea what to do, and there was nobody there really to guide us at that time. So it was very, very challenging.
And you and your husband have multiple children, biological and adopted, some with differing abilities. How have you navigated the joys and challenges of family life while being a military family?
We had 5 years as a military couple without children, and then we had about another 7 or so with children. When we decided to grow our family, we had one child in 2005, and then we just had her for a while. And then we went from 1 to 4 children in about 2.5 years. And as you mentioned, you know, our family is built through biological means, but also through adoption. And so we were able to grow our family very quickly, somewhat intentionally, but somewhat unintentionally, in a very short time period. And, you know, to be honest with you, I don't really remember much of that time. I was just surviving, right? I was just putting one foot in front of the other, trying to get through each minute because it was just intense. My husband was constantly at work, and when I say constantly, I mean 6 or 7 days a week for 16 to 20 hours a day. He was just gone all the time. I managed the children. the house, our family. I did all of it because he just wasn't there. I took advantage of all kinds of child care and preschool options that I could find and that we could afford. That gave me the breaks that I needed. I accepted help when it was offered to me. I was never very good at asking for help unless I was going to pay somebody. So I was perfectly fine hiring someone to mow the lawn. I was perfectly fine hiring someone to come install a ceiling fan or whatever, or watch my children or whatever. But I wasn't very good at asking for favors. You know, there's this mentality, I think, sometimes that exists that just says, well, you know, these military wives, military partners, they signed up for this. Well, you know, as flawed as that statement is, and as much as that statement makes me kind of crazy, there was an essence of it that permeated my own line of thinking, which is why I was very reluctant to ask for help. I signed up for this, right? So I should be able to handle it. I should be able to do it. And so I just need to, you know, get up and keep moving and army strong. And here I am. And, you know, army of one, I can do this and keep going. And so I did. But I didn't handle it well. The kids suffered. I suffered. My husband suffered. Our marriage suffered. You know, it was more than one person could or should have, you know, had to deal with. You know, and there are plenty of things then as a result that are broken in our family. Somehow, though, our kids are relatively well-adjusted. They at least behave well for other people and in school and in public, but I'm not entirely sure how that happened. You know, really, it was just a matter of survival. And if I did anything right, it was that I took enough space when I needed it. I spent the money or took advantage of the time where I could put the children in one place with some responsible adult that wasn't me, and I could go get done what I needed to do, or I could get done nothing, but that I put that space between us. If I did anything right, that's probably what I did. But when I heard that question, I thought, we didn't navigate it very well. I don't think that we did, but I mean, my kids are pretty decent, so I guess we did something right. I'm just not entirely sure what that is.
Now, your husband also deals with combat stress. So you have, you're raising this beautiful family, and with his combat stress and mental health issues related to his military service, how has that impacted your family? And what role do you play in advocating for services?
You know, I think he was dealing with combat stress and depression for a long time. Long time before I think I realized it. You know, I think because we've never dealt with flashbacks or nightmares or explosive behavior, we've never dealt with anything that's real explosive like that. It's always been just him kind of turning inward and sinking into his own little dark space. And so because of that, I don't think I really noticed how bad it was getting until it got really, really, really bad. You know, and I think sometimes, too, I was just so mad at him for not being around and not being able to participate that I think, too, I just continued to distance myself and kind of write him off because that hurt less. I don't think that it was probably the right thing to do, you know, and I still blame myself for not seeing what was going on with him sooner, for not intervening sooner. But when I finally recognized how bad it was, I remember kind of feeling like I was this person standing outside of our house, or standing outside of our family, just kind of watching. At the time, we had three children. I remember feeling like I was watching all of us on a train that was headed for this fiery crash at the end that I could see from this outside perspective, but that I was powerless to do anything. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to stop it. I didn't know how to slow it down. I didn't know. I just knew it was going to happen. That there was going to be this terrible crash. I didn't know if any of us would survive, if some of us would survive. I had no idea. I just knew that it was going to happen. And that's when I started really focusing and looking at, okay, is there something here I'm missing? Is there something I can do? I'm a fixer, and I like to fix stuff. And so it was very hard for me. And, you know, I remember that at one point, you know, he had tried multiple avenues to get help. He had tried to get a job change within the military. He had tried to reach out for a mentor at work to help him. he had reached out to mental health professionals on post, and just he just met a wall every time, and that continued to deepen his depression. And, you know, it just got so bad that he began to hint he would begin to say things that were suicidal. And this was where I was like, okay, so now I see this train, and he's at least giving me something, and so maybe if I call, right, maybe if I say this is what's happening, then we'll stop that fiery crash, or at least we can slow that down. You know, I knew that when I made that call to his unit, because that's kind of the way you do it when you're active duty and as a family member, when I made that call to his unit and told them what was going on, you know, and why he wasn't coming to work and why he wasn't answering the phone calls, I knew at that time that his career was going to be over. Due to the nature of the work that he did for the military, I knew that this was it and that we were going to be done. But I felt like this was the only option I had to potentially avoid all of us burning in this crash that I felt like we were headed for. And so I did, and so I made that call. That started his med board process. You know, my kids were little during that time, so I had, they were about five or so, and then I had a baby. So they didn't really notice, you know, he was gone, when he was gone in the hospital, you know, the children didn't even notice that he wasn't there, because he just wasn't ever there. And so I feel like in some ways I was lucky that that was, that they were so little and that they were so used to him being gone that they didn't notice, because that just meant it was one less thing I had to explain. And they just kind of carried on about their normal business. You know, he navigated a lot of the med board process himself, largely because it was his sole job at the time. He could devote his energy to that. Depression and combat stress really make it almost, it makes it very, very difficult for him to pour his energy into more than one purpose. So he could either do the job that the military had asked him to do, or he could focus on getting better, or he could focus on the med board, or, you know, he could do just one thing. And so he was able to focus just on the med board process. And, you know, I checked over things. I made sure that nobody was trying to do any shady business. I, you know, made sure that things were being done fairly and correctly and justly and according to regulations and due process and things like this. And, you know, and when there was something that kind of perked up, I would say, hey, we need to investigate that little bit right there. You need to check into that again. And he would go do that. You know, and in the end, he ended up medically retired. And I knew that would happen, and I think it was the best outcome for us. It was, he needed to be done. He couldn't do this anymore. You know, he's greatly improved now. He still struggles with some aspects of combat stress and depression. He has some memory problems, and I do have to advocate for him at his medical appointments and with the VA and, you know, within other things to make sure that we're covering all the bases and that everything's getting handled. And the bulk of our, I would say 99% of basic family responsibilities fall on my shoulders and are on my plate. You know, he can execute lots of tasks, and he's very capable of doing things when I give him kind of a punch list of things to do. But if it's too multifaceted or if it's too involved, it's something that I have to step in and do. Sometimes because it will just take him so much longer. Other times because it requires so much multitasking or so much communication that he just really, really finds it challenging. So, you know, there's a lot that I do because he still just can't as a result of kind of the depression and the combat stress and just things like this.
Yeah, and you mentioned that he has been officially separated from service. So what was your family's experience in transitioning out of the military?
So the med board took about 18 months. We were finally separated, and we were really, really happy. We were very happy. We had a party with some of our close family members. For us, we really, truly felt like we were free. The military is a great experience for many, many people, and it is a wonderful organization for many, many individuals and families. It was not for us. And so for us, it was challenge after challenge after challenge. And it was just extremely traumatic and difficult for us the entire time he was in, which was almost 13 years. And so when we finally were done and released, if you will, we felt released. We felt free. And we were really happy. He spent about 10 months trying to find a new job for him and a new place for us to land, you know, in terms of location. And it took almost a year to do that. And we did, and he found a new job, and we found a new place to live and a home. You know, once that dust settled, and I felt like he was good, I felt like the children were good, I felt like everybody that I was responsible for was good, that's when I started to realize what all this had kind of done to me. You know, we spent all that time making sure it didn't do anything to the children or handling whatever it had done to the children. I spent all that time making sure that he was okay and that he was in his appointments and making sure he was handled. But my own self, I just, and this is part of just who I am, I just brush it off. You know, I noticed that I was a lot more accultured to the military than I had thought. You know, I would see, in the community we live in, it's not anywhere near a military installation. And so when we moved here, and I remember being somewhere seeing a helicopter. It was at a festival or something. I saw a helicopter, and I thought to myself, oh, where are the rest of them? Because there was only one. Well, there was only one because it was Life Flight, you know, it was an ambulance helicopter. And so there's not eight of them flying in a training mission. There's just one of them. And I remember thinking, oh, right, they're not military. You know, or I remember this very distinctly, there was an experience where I was home with the children, my husband was gone at work or something, and there was a knock on my front door. And now, we moved back to a community from where we knew a lot of people already, but most people have always known never to come to my front door. For a lot of military wives, and especially myself, everybody always knew, don't come to the front door. Bad news comes to the front door. Don't come to the front door. So when my front door knocked, and usually I would see, you know, the UPS person does that, right? So I would see the truck out there. So I didn't freak out if I heard the doorbell ring and I saw the truck out the window as I was going to the door. But this time I didn't see a truck. And I remember thinking, huh, that's really bizarre. And I opened the door, and there were these two men standing there in suits, just regular business suits. And they said to me, is this the Wells household? And I remember I couldn't hear anything aside of what they were saying. I didn't hear any of the television or the children, and I remember I couldn't breathe. And they said, are you Mrs. Wells? And at that point, I really just kind of lost all the air in the room. And I grabbed onto something because I couldn't quite steady myself. And I said, I am. And they said, well, you know, we're here from thus and such church down the road, and then the adrenaline dropped out, right? Because now I knew, oh, these were just people coming to welcome us to the neighborhood. And now I was kind of hyperventilating, you know, and these poor sweet souls of individuals felt terrible, because I said, now you just have to stop for a minute. And I just kind of caught my breath, and I explained, you know, what I was, who I was, and what had gone on in that moment. And I remember they felt terrible. And I just remember then thinking to myself, my thought was, oh my God, something's happened to him. Because anytime somebody comes to your front door and knocks and then asks if this is the right family and then asks if you are Mrs. So-and-so, you know, then that is bad news. But here I was in a civilian community, you know, so that was one of those real startling moments for me. There was also, I started to realize, just this lack of attachment and the inability to attach to my husband again emotionally, even though this period of our lives was over. You know, there were these lack of feelings and coldness just towards things in general, a real kind of pessimistic attitude, no unicorns or rainbows in my world, and a lot of just reluctance to process, because this has been an ongoing cycle for so long, for over a decade, that what was working was working, and I didn't want to deal with it. And I think to a degree that's still true. I don't want to deal with it, because I'm surviving, and if I stop to deal with it, I'm not sure what would break apart. And so I'm still in that phase now, even still. And it's very challenging, because I know that there's a bunch of mess deep down in there that needs to be dealt with, but I've got four little kids, and I just haven't let myself do it yet. So we'll see how much longer I can hold that together before I guess I really have to deal with it. You know, but getting out of the military was the right thing. And we were very happy that that's what ended up happening. So our transition was stressful emotionally for me, but it was definitely a sense of relief for us.
Yes, with those types of transitions and experiences, now that your husband is no longer actively serving in the military, how does your family identify or even connect with the military at this point?
You know, we still have our, part of the medical retirement included our health insurance. So we still, and my husband, you know, still receives some services at the VA. And so we, you know, through those channels, I was really glad that our medical insurance didn't change because I had already spent 13 years learning it backwards and forwards, and I didn't want to have to learn a new insurance plan. You know, so through those channels, some of that's all still the same because I can still use all the same lingo and language, and they, you know, still know all of that too. I keep in touch with many of our friends still through social media, phone calls, texts, emails, and there are a couple of social media groups that I am a part of, and especially ones that have, for members who have a spouse that has some kind of combat-related injury or disability, and so I stay pretty connected through that. My job also keeps me pretty connected within that community, and you know what's changing, and just kind of in that stream. But you know, I think my husband really hasn't. He's on social media, and I think he kind of follows, you know, certain, you know, pages or whatever, and you know, kind of things like that. But he's not very engaged. I don't know that he wants to be. You know, he left the military with lots of usable skills, and he works in the civilian sector in the same similar field as he did in the military. And some of those individuals are prior service that he works with. And one thing I've noticed for him in his line of work is that there is a different connection and a bond that he makes with the individuals, with his colleagues who are also prior service. There's a different level of trust. There's a different level of camaraderie. There's a different level of understanding that happens amongst these prior service members, especially if they were, if they experienced combat. There's just a real uniqueness to it. And for me, I think that kind of warms my heart in a special way because I feel like, well, at least then now in his world, in his professional world, he's got somebody who gets it, and they need that. You know, he stays connected, I think, through stories with friends that he works with, things like this. His dad was prior service. We have two nephews that are currently active duty. You know, so he, I think, through this male bonding story sharing thing, that might help him some, but he doesn't really want much to do with it on a an official level.
How has your family's military experience impacted your children at this time?
Right. So the older my kids got, the more I had to figure out how to explain things to them. You know, when my husband deployed, when my oldest daughter was about 4, I was very careful as to what we told her. I knew military families who had told their children that daddy was going off to hunt and kill bad guys. And, you know, if that's what you tell your child, then that is what you tell your child. But that was not what I was going to tell my child. And so I was very careful and not use the country of where he was going. I didn't want her to know because I was afraid, what if she said, well, my daddy is in Afghanistan or wherever and, you know, working. And that was what she said at school. But then at school, some other kids said, oh, yeah, well, my daddy went to Afghanistan, and he's hunting and killing bad guys. You know, I just didn't want her to connect those things potentially. So I was very, very careful about what I told her. And we ended up going with that daddy went far, far away for work. And at the age of 4, that was enough for her. She was perfectly fine with that answer. But as they got older, and as the impact of him going far, far away for work increased, on his own mental health and our family, we had to start explaining things. And, you know, so my children know, 3 of my children are old enough now to know that, yeah, daddy went to war. He went to war 3 times. As a result of that, you know, you can't run into the room and jump on the bed and wake him up. You probably should stand by the foot of the bed and call out his name to wake him up. And, you know, they know what it means when I say, okay, go wake up your dad, go wake him gently. They know what that means. they know that they can't hide behind something and jump out and scare him, as kids like to sometimes do. They know that that will probably end very badly because his startle reflex is so strong. You know, I've had to explain to our five-year-old, who in particular, she is extremely fierce and throws some quite impressive temper tantrums that seem to trigger something in my husband, and I don't know what it is, but it really, really triggers something in him, and he knows well enough to remove himself, and he goes in our bedroom and locks the door, and he puts in some headphones and listens to white noise and calms down, but her fits trigger something in him, and I've had to sit down with her and say, hey, look, you know, I don't know what your dad went through. I have no idea, but whenever you do that, you know, not only should you not be throwing a fit like that because it's just unbelievable, but two, it's triggering this reaction in him, and that's hard for him, and that hurts him. And, you know, so I've had to explain to her why this is not appropriate for reasons beyond, it's just not appropriate, you know. And I think the kids also noticed some of his lack of memory and his lack of engagement, perhaps the lack of engagement on both of our parts, but, you know, they know that he doesn't remember stuff very well. You know, they know that it's hard for him to do some things. So yeah, I mean, it's impacted them in just that they know kind of these limitations. They don't know the nitty-gritty to what all happened. I don't know that I even know all of it, quite frankly. But they know that, you know, this is just the way it is because Daddy went to war.
Now, as a military spouse, you filled the roles of wife, mother, caregiver, and advocate. What strategies did you use to take care of yourself?
Right. You know, I always was happy and willing to accept help when it was offered and when it was specific. Somebody said to me, let me know if there's anything I can do. I said, oh, okay, yeah, thanks. But I really wouldn't reach out. Really, even to this day, I'm only willing to ask for help from some of my closest friends. I just don't. I am happy to pay for someone to come help, for a babysitter, for somebody to mow the lawn, for somebody to fix something, but I'm not very good at asking a favor. So that was hard for me. But when it was offered, I took it. And I was never afraid to leave my children with other individuals who I thought were perfectly responsible. Some mothers really struggle with that, and I just never did. I still don't. You want my children? Oh, yes, please, go take them. I'm happy to leave them with you. And so that gave me that space that I needed to kind of get some space between me and the kids. I stayed real active in a faith community and some other organizations, hobby organizations, where I could make friends. I'm very, very extroverted, and so I needed that chance to be with people. Currently, I spend a lot of time at the gym, and I have a lot of friends there. Then, you know, that's another outlet for me. And I've never let myself feel guilty for being away from my children. You know, I feel like I am a better mother because I do take that space. And I still do it to this day. You know, I have a regular babysitter 2 evenings a week to help me get that space. You know, I work to help me get that space. When I realized this idea of being there for them at every turn was killing me, then I was, this isn't going to work for anybody. And so let's get some space here, and then we can all be better for it. And that's kind of how I handled that and still do.
Well, that's really good to hear that you have given yourself permission to do that. What suggestions do you have for military service providers who work with families that have been encountering multiple transitions?
So I think one of the things that I would say initially would be that for any therapist or anybody treating or working with a spouse or anyone in general who is having trouble adjusting to military life, I think it's absolutely critical to evaluate with that person their individual past to see if there's some kind of past experience that the current situation is triggering. My response to the military and the lack of control, the daily unpredictability, just the fear, the chaos, all of that was, it triggered in me the same physical reaction that I had as a result of a trauma many years before ever even meeting my husband. This idea that somebody could just do what they wanted at any time and upend my life in any way, shape, or form that they wanted created this intense fear and chaos and pain in me that when I stopped long enough for really only a hot minute to realize that this was the same exact physical reaction I remember having at the moment when this other trauma took place 20-some-odd years ago. That's when I went, oh, if I had only recognized that in the beginning, maybe we would have had an easier experience. But I didn't even recognize that those two things were connected until we were just about finished with our military experience. So for those who work, you know, in that kind of clinical setting with individuals in a therapy-type setting, I would suggest that that's probably something extremely crucial. It may not be that that's why they're having trouble adjusting. However, it's worth it to evaluate it. Me and my therapist never explored that. And had we may have figured it out earlier and things could have been different. I don't know. And I don't beat myself up about it. I just know that that would have been helpful perhaps. You know, the other thing for individuals who work with anybody or who even just with amongst colleagues who support military families, advise those people that are supporting the family to offer specific help, very specific help. Can I take your kids on Tuesday? You know, can I bring you dinner on Thursday? You know, can I mow your lawn this summer for you because I know that your spouse is gone. We had a sweet old couple who lived next door, and he had a riding mower, and he would come next door without ever being asked. He knew my husband was gone, and he would come on his mower and just buzz right around the front of my yard for me all summer long when my husband was gone. And that was the most touching thing for me, you know, because I didn't have to ask anybody, and he didn't even ask if it was okay. He just did it because he knew. They were a retired military couple next door. They were sweet, sweet, sweet people. And, you know, that was helpful. The other thing perhaps for service providers is have military families make a list. Make a list of the things that you need help with. You know, do you need someone to mow your lawn? Do you need someone, you know, if something breaks on the car, do you need somebody who can help you with that? What do you need? Make a list of those specific things that you need. Even if it is, hey, I need a casserole brought to me once a week. You know, put it on the list. And then when somebody says, is there anything I can do to help? You have a list. And you can go, well, yeah, here, these are the things I could use some help with. And then that gives, it takes some pressure off the person offering. It also takes some pressure off you who needs it because it's all right there on a piece of paper. And you don't have to worry that, well, maybe that person doesn't like to cook, or maybe that person is allergic to grass and won't mow my yard. And then I get shot down for asking, and I'm never asking again. And so if you have this list, it allows people to choose what they can do for you without waiting for them to read your mind and be specific. The other thing I would suggest is to listen to the family members that you work with. Don't try to fix their feelings. Feelings are for feelings, and any therapist worth their salt is going to know that. But in general, don't try to fix people's feelings. Don't encourage them to just be strong and play the part. You know, even to this day, this very moment, I feel inadequate enough, you know, all by myself. I don't need to just be told to, you know, buck up and be strong, or be told that, well, others have it worse than you. You know, there was an old line in an old TV show years ago called Ally McBeal, and somebody said to Ally McBeal once, Ally, what makes your problem so much bigger than everybody else's? And she said to them, she said, because they're mine. And there's so much truth to that statement. And so don't try to minimize what somebody's going through. What they're going through, what they're feeling, that is 100% real and true for them. So let them feel it. And sometimes there's this idea of holding space, and you know, you can Google that, and lots of different blog posts come up about it. But this idea of just sitting there with somebody. You know, I never experienced a real knock at my front door or a phone call saying that he was injured. Or that something had happened. I never experienced that. I have friends who have. And there's nothing to be said in that moment. But what can be done in that moment is somebody else's body there. Because in that moment, just the physical presence of someone else, whether they say anything or not, helps to divide the grief that fills that room. or the fear, or, you know, this sorrow, whatever it might be. It helps to divide that amongst these two humans, and it lessens it for the one who's really going through it. You know, so just that idea of just being there, and not, as hard as it is, not fixing anything, but just listening and holding that kind of space is also crucial.
Well, you have given military service providers some great suggestions and ideas and tips. And are there any other resources that you think would be helpful to service providers at this time that you haven't mentioned?
Right. I mean, there's lots and lots and lots of resources out there and organizations that do great, great work, and they're well known. The one thing that I think that kind of occurred to me was for practitioners, if possible, to make friends with military families who are not your clients. Become friends with a military family, because that's going to give you a perspective that you won't have as a practitioner, because your friends might be more transparent with you than your clients. Your friends and your deep closeness and compassion with your friends will change your perspective, will change you in a way that your clients may not, because, of course, there is a boundary there, right, that is very different than the boundaries between friends. And I think some of the greatest resources can be, for practitioners, those individuals with whom they are just friends, but who are military families themselves, because I think that there can be a lot more back and forth and push and pull between family, or between friends rather, than perhaps between clients, that would offer a new lens, I think.
Well, that is an excellent suggestion for a resource for military service providers. And on behalf of the Military Families Learning Network and Family Transitions, I really want to thank you for taking this time to share your transition, as a military family, and your life story in the military with us. We're very grateful that you could be with us today. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity. So thank you.
This has been an interview with a military spouse who has provided us with insights on her family's military transition experiences. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us. I am Anita Herring, social media specialist with the Military Families Learning Network Family Transitions Concentration Area, an extension educator with the University of Minnesota Extension. To listen to more podcasts, participate in webinars, read blogs, or access other resources, please go to militaryfamilies, all one word, .extension.org/family-transitions. Thanks, and have a great day.